Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Global Marketing Podcast, where we talk to people who have had a lot of international experience and marketing experience to find out the best practices and what you can do to make sure you are also doing global marketing. And today, we've got somebody who has a ton of international experience, and you're going to be fascinated listening to some of her stories. I'd like to welcome Stephanie Hendricks.
Hi, Wendy. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So it's pushing lunchtime here. You're in California, so you're a little bit behind time-wise, right?
I'm actually on the East Coast right now, so I get to stay up for California hours, but I'm on the East Coast.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I got that wrong. Okay.
No, because we keep talking about California, all the crises going on. So I'm always talking about California, but I actually don't live in California.
Okay. All right. Well, now we've got, so you're pushing lunchtime too then.
I am. Yes. Yeah.
All right. So Stephanie, you have a bachelor's in government and you're president of and co-founder of the Eric Hendricks Memorial Foundation, and you're currently the vice president of operations and customer service at Voltus.
Right. Yes.
And you were a board member and secretary of the Women in Manufacturing of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For a couple of years, I was part of the group that got it up and running. Great. Group of women. It was a really good experience.
Is it still up and running now?
I think so. Yeah. I was working in artificial intelligence and very manufacturing focused. And then when I transitioned to this new job a couple years ago, or actually it was a year and a half ago, that's when I needed to focus because I basically was working 24/7. So I didn't want to drop the ball. They needed someone who could be more reliable in terms of meetings. So But they're a great group of very focused women who have great vision, and I'm still part of the group, but not on the board.
Oh, wonderful! I'll have to check it out.
Yeah.
All right, and then you had a career in the military. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was a naval intelligence officer. I participated in ROTC, so the Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps, we call it ROTC. That is a program that you do while in school. So I went to Harvard, and the ROTC program was hosted and still is hosted at MIT. So my morning engineering classes were at MIT. And then on a Wednesday, I was commissioned as a naval officer. And on a Thursday, I graduated from college. And on a Friday, I reported. So that was the beginning of the end of my college and the beginning of my career in the Navy. I ended up going down to Virginia Beach for my training. The intelligence schoolhouse is in Virginia Beach, and I did two deployments. One, I was on the USS Theodore Roosevelt in the Gulf. I was part of an air wing, Air Wing 8. It was a great air wing. And we flew missions in Iraq and Afghanistan, so we were part of OIF and OEF. And then I went back about 6 months later. When the ship came back, I went back about 6 months later, and I lived in Bahrain. I did a small little couple weeks in Djibouti, and I was a counterterrorism analyst. So I spent a fair amount of time over in the Middle East, and I got two really interesting deployments. I had a couple of different roles in my 4.5 years of active duty. I left in fall 2009, and I stayed as a inactive reservist until fall 2017. So that was my Navy career. So I'm officially a veteran now. Yeah, before I was an inactive reservist, but now I'm a veteran.
Now you're a vet. Okay. Yeah. Well, tell us about Bahrain. You must have had some interesting cultural experiences there.
It was really interesting because there's a causeway between Bahrain. So if people, and this isn't a condescending thing, if I hadn't been in the military, I'm not sure I would have known where Bahrain was on a map, but it's a little island off the coast of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And there's a long causeway that connects Bahrain to Saudi Arabia. And
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so you have actually a fair amount of people from Saudi Arabia coming over, mostly men, coming over. You also have a fair amount of expats who actually work in Saudi Arabia, but they live in Bahrain, usually because if they have families, Bahrain's, a lot more Western friendly. Mm-hmm. You can also have a beer in Bahrain, and you cannot in Saudi Arabia.
So. How interesting. So you get everybody living over in Bahrain, but working over there.
Right, exactly. So it was really interesting because there's a naval base in Bahrain. It's fairly big. But I lived in an apartment off base. Mm-hmm. And so I was in a building where you can only have a percentage of the building can only be American, because you don't want to have a concentration of Americans for a variety of reasons. And so it was nice to meet different people. I met expats who were working, again, who would travel to Saudi Arabia during the day.
What were the biggest culture, like, you talk about going into another country and having culture shock. Mm-hmm. You were there with the military. What were the biggest cultural shocks that you had for living there?
So that's really interesting. So I'm type A, very on schedule and lots of planning. And there is a tendency for things to not keep on schedule. Like I was told many times that so-and-so was on their way, and I would sit and wait, and so-and-so would literally never show up. I would call them and say, so I'm here and I'm waiting. Are you still coming? Oh yes, I'm on my way. And then they would never show up. And it was the strangest thing I had ever experienced. And so that one was a culture shock to me. Like, Wendy, if we're supposed to have coffee and I call you and you say, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm on my way, I expect at least in like 10 to 20 minutes, you might be showing up.
Right. Yeah.
Wendy, this would be like, you would pick up your phone and actively tell me you were on your way. And then I would stay there and you would never show up.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. So you could end up waiting there for hours, or you could show up someplace and nobody could come.
Correct. And that happened quite a lot. And as a type A person, that wasn't my favorite thing, but, they're also
so certain- how do you adapt to that? So say you're going over to do business there, you're in the military and you have that. So you can either just get aggravated and be a mad type A all the time, or you can adapt. Like, how do you, that, right. 'Cause that was a cultural thing. It's less.
It was very, yeah, it yeah. wasn't. It wasn't, and then people explain, oh yeah, that's of course. So you just kind of had to, now if I had, I was living there, right? So, okay, yeah. It didn't work out today. Let's hope for tomorrow. But if you are flying over there, I mean, my recommendation would be you go to them. Like if they have an office or if they have a home that you're welcomed into, you go to them, right? Meeting somewhere or having them come to you,
that puts you on the waiting end and takes a little bit of the control away, right? So now you're waiting, that hoping that they show up. Whereas if you go to their office, they're probably going to be there at some point in the day. So that would be my recommendation for that. It gives you a little more control of the situation to go somewhere where they will be.
That makes sense, because if they're off doing something, eventually they'll come back to their office.
So right.
Sit there and wait, you know, eventually.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting place because of the military presence, there's a fair amount of like Western, I don't want to say Western because I don't want it to sound like it's lost its culture, but there is, there's definitely, you know, what are the restaurants in the areas that they're welcoming and excited to have Americans or British or European people. And then there's some areas, so there's, you know, there's also the culture in like the Shia Sunni situation without like even putting the Americans in that situation. So there's some areas where you just wouldn't go because there was already like local tension. So you just have to be very cognizant of have a friendly local person just kind of give you the lay of the land and say, you know, this area is really friendly and this is, you know, these hotels and these restaurants in this area, very open to Westerners or non-locals, and this area probably you shouldn't. And I always, always, always had a head covering in my car, mostly because my greatest fear was that I would accidentally get on the causeway, which, you know, once you get on it, I think there's like one turnaround point, but luckily I never got on it. But I did not want to end up in Saudi Arabia as a woman, to be perfectly honest, because I know you can be there, but there's so many rules that I was so afraid of that I wouldn't do something properly and I would mess something up. So that was actually one of the things I was most nervous about, was accidentally ending up in Saudi Arabia. Again, not because I was afraid of like anything necessarily bad. It was because I didn't know the rules as well as I should. And I didn't want to ever disrespect Saudi Arabia's culture, but with, you know, just from ignorance, not knowing what I was supposed to do or what I wasn't supposed to do. So I always had a head covering, just like worst case scenario, to be respectful. And then I also just drove very slowly when I was in the area where the causeway, there was like a roundabout that I was always afraid I was going to like go off the wrong exit on the roundabout and end up on the causeway. So I always drove very slowly around there.
So it's very interesting. So here you are in two predominantly Muslim areas of the world, and one was more westernized in that you felt like you could operate more easily, but in Saudi Arabia, which I think of as more Americans or Europeans going into, had stricter rules that everybody had to follow, so you had to learn.
Right. And because I wasn't living there, I knew like there were rules, and again, this wasn't like a judgment thing, this was a, on my part, I had never experienced it, so I didn't know what to expect, and I didn't know how to, I just was worried that I would unintentionally offend or insult. And so that was like, I felt very safe in Bahrain, and I would probably be very safe in Saudi Arabia. It was more of like, in Bahrain, it was a little more like alignment with what I knew and how I knew how to behave just as a respectable human being. And in Saudi Arabia, I think there's just and again, I don't even know, I think they've changed, but there are just more rules. And so as someone, a woman who would be driving around Bahrain with no head covering and alone in a car as a woman, that was natural for me. In Bahrain, it was totally fine. In Saudi Arabia, there's like little different spin on it. And I still, to this day, don't know what is appropriate and what is not. So I wanted to be respectful of all the cultures, no matter where I was. And right. So that was the, you know, Bahrain is very, it has a lot of cultures. It's a melting pot of Middle Easterners. You've got Pakistanis, Indians, of course, Saudi Arabians, and then you've got Brits and the Americans, because the American base, you've got Shias, you've got Sunnis. There's a lot going on, but be respectful, and it was fine. Saudi Arabia just had stricter rules, and I didn't totally understand them or know them, and so it was more of my ignorance that made me worried that I was going to, unintentionally insult or dishonor their culture.
Yeah, how about Djibouti?
Oh, Djibouti. I never left the base. Oh, that's a lie. Okay. So I flew to Djibouti.
Your story, you'll believe it.
Yeah.
I barely left the base.
Yeah. Well, I only left the base to leave the country. So
okay. Yeah. So right. When you were in the country, you never left the base.
I never left the base.
And right. Why was that?
I was only there for a few weeks, and I was only supposed to be there for I can't even remember the timeline. I think I was only supposed to be there for a week or 10 days. So what happened was the aircraft that brought me was a military aircraft. So I left from I left from Bahrain's airport, and I landed on the base in a military aircraft. Uh-huh. And then the aircraft kept breaking. So my flight home kept getting delayed. And this was, I think it was right before Christmas 2006, mm-hmm. or right after. I think it was right before Christmas 2006. And I was a counterterrorism analyst. And there was some stuff heating up. And I needed to go back. I needed to get back to Bahrain to be at my home base, to be doing what I was supposed to be doing for my job. This was when the CIC, the Council of Islamic Courts, was ruling Somalia. And there was just a lot going on. And the Horn of Africa was one of my areas of expertise. And so there's a lot going on, and the plane kept breaking.
Oh, okay. So that's
so I needed to get back to Bahrain. And so eventually, after many days of just being oh, nope, the flight's still not going to take off, da, 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 they just booked me on a commercial flight. And so I had to go to the commercial side of the airport in Djibouti, which is shared by the military as well. But I went to the commercial side, and I got on a plane and I flew to Ethiopia. I had an 8-hour layover in Ethiopia, which I'm devastated because I always wanted to go to Ethiopia and I never got to leave the airport, but I was there for 8 hours. And then I flew to Dubai. And then from Dubai, I finally got a flight to Bahrain. So 30 hours later, I was back and briefing on the some current events that were happening. So I didn't
really get a feel for the culture.
No, I unfortunately did not. I did fly with a bunch of very nice people who spoke French to me, and I was honored that they thought I could speak French back.
Usually
you take one look at me and you just start speaking English.
Okay. You have dark hair and dark eyes, light skinned. So I could see somebody mistaking.
Yes, but yeah. I was very complimentary, but I unfortunately couldn't speak back to them in French. So
yeah,
that was my only real experience. Everyone was very nice, but yes, I unfortunately could not speak French back.
Okay, so you've worked internationally with the Navy.
Right.
And in your position, which we'll get into in a little bit, you also do international work. And I'm curious, did either organization give you any kind of cultural training or communications advanced support or training before you started doing work in these places?
That's really interesting. I think because of my role, the specific responsibilities, maybe other intelligence officers, because my role in Bahrain was was considered an individual augmentation. So they had a role, a gap that they needed to fill. And so I was assigned to the air wing and they needed an intelligence officer. So they go around and they go to different units and say, we need an intelligence officer, or we need a so-and-so type of person. And then you individually get deployed. So I didn't go with my unit. I didn't go with my air wing to Bahrain on the second deployment. And so I think maybe if it had not been an individual augmentation, that there may have been more like preparation and cultural, because I do know there's a lot of courses, like when people are going to go get stationed overseas, you know, in Seoul, South Korea, and different places. I think there are prep courses more in the military. Mm-hmm. I was an individual augmentation, so it was like you get a few weeks notice and then you're shipped over. So I think just my experience, the answer is no, but I don't think that is across the military. I do think they do a lot of cultural trainings. You know, if you show up in Germany, you're in doc. There's in doc, and so. I just happened to get the IA situation, so a little less cultural.
So they're not going to, because it was a pretty quick turnaround.
Right, exactly. So. I think also different roles like a cryptologist, I'm sure they do much more cultural and like alignment with what the region is that they'll
be. Yeah, so talk to me. Yeah. Tell me what a cryptologist is.
So an intelligence officer is someone who, this would be my version of it, is takes all the pieces of information and tries to understand the story. What's going on and how can we prepare and ensure the operator? So an operator would be, special forces, people on the ground, troops on the ground, pilots, people who operate the ships, the submarines, like those are the operators. Yeah. And so intelligence officers need to provide them the valuable information that ensures whatever their mission is, they're like safe and successful. And they have everything they need. They have the story. They have the different the different scenarios, what they could see. You know, if you're flying, if you go in country, so you fly a mission in Afghanistan or over Iraq or whatever country, what could you see? What sort of missiles? What sort of so any other aircraft in the air? And then what is your mission and what do you need to know to be successful? Again, it's the intelligence officers are providing that information, but the operators also have other sources of information and they have their experience. So it's all about helping create the full picture. And a cryptologist, if a cryptologist listens to this, they may find me and retrain me. but
your story, your definition.
Yeah, what I thought about the cryptologist was really interesting. I would take pieces of information and tell a story. They would find the pieces of information. So there's limitations on what I can exactly talk about, but what to me, cryptologists have like more of like the tech using, leveraging technology to find the piece of information that are critical. And then, so one of the pieces of information I might get might come from a cryptologist, and then the other might come from an analyst, who is not a cryptologist. So then I would see the story from the analyst, and I'd see the like very amazing detail from the cryptologist, and I would try and put it together and see if they were related, see if that like they filled in some holes. That's just to be careful about how much I say. That would be how I describe it.
Right. And so the cryptologist also is a native language speaker then?
It depends. And so a cryptologist is not necessarily, but a resource for an intelligence officer or a cryptologist can sometimes be. So cryptologist is more of like tech. So more of, signals and an interception.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and I was trying to figure out if they're gathering information on a country that doesn't speak English, mm-hmm. a lot of that information isn't going to be in English. And so they have to give it to you to write the report.
So they would have a translator, same as a human person. So anyone who does human intelligence, so that's people who talk to people, like
interpreters.
Locals. Mm-hmm. So they'll have interpreters to understand the language. And sometimes they speak the language.
Okay, so the cryptologist really goes out and finds the information, but then they pull in a translator.
If needed, yep.
If needed. Okay, I understood cryptologists were native language speakers researching it and then translating it to give it to you.
But I see. Yeah, no. So, I mean, there might be some cases of that, but in my experience, most of it is they speak English or maybe another language, but not necessarily the language of what country they're in.
All right, so that was in the military. Since you were individual, then you didn't go through any country training.
Correct.
Now you're working for a company. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the company does and where you have locations?
Okay, great. Yeah. So Voltus is a demand response. It's an energy company. So what we do is you have the grid, and the grid is, in like the simplest terms, has supply and demand. And supply is, you know, your generation units, your solar, your wind, your natural gas, nuclear, coal plants. Mm-hmm. And then demand is you and me and huge malls and commercial buildings and manufacturers. And so we work with, so you and me would be residential, mm-hmm. but big manufacturers and you know, farms and commercial real estate, they're considered C&I, commercial industrial. Those are huge demands on the grid. So when they turn their lights on, they're using a lot more kilowatts than when you and I turn our lights on at our house. And so we work with on the C&I side, on the demand side. And so basically the grid has all these different assets. You have the supply side, which are the assets that generate power.
Right.
And then on the demand side, we are the demand. We want to use the power.
Right.
Well, what happens when supply is limited or there's an unexpected outage, or recently there's all of the above, there's unexpected outages, there's heat waves. So now the supply is lower than expected and it's certainly lower than needed. And then the demand is continuously going up because of a heat wave. So now you have too little supply mixed with too much demand. So there's different options for the grid. The grid can go and buy very expensive energy, you know, day of very expensive energy, which means that all the rate payers are going to be paying very expensive rates for that power. Mm-hmm. They can do rolling blackouts because they need to not take out the entire grid. They'll do rolling blackouts so that they can maintain control, but keep with the supply they have, they do rolling blackouts to help just, again, control the blackouts. Yeah. Or what they can do is they can use a company like Voltus, where we are a demand response company and they send us a signal and they say, we need you to take 100 megawatts or 50 megawatts off the grid, mm-hmm. either tomorrow or in 2 hours, or some of our programs are, we get 10 minutes notice. In 10 minutes, we need 50 megawatts off the grid. And so what that does is it helps balance the supply and demand. And so we work across all of the regions, and including Canada, so in Alberta and Ontario, and then in the US, all of the different grids. And we've created a network of commercial and industrial sites that will curtail their power usage. So some of them will just turn it down a little, and some will just completely shut off everything.
Okay, so right now you're in Canada and the U.S.
Correct.
And are you in other countries?
We are going to be, but we are not currently in any other countries. Okay. Canada and US only for now. Right now. Right.
And this is where we, you know, our conversation before was very interesting. So which countries are you targeting to go into?
Yeah, so we actually did a big evaluation. It started, I think, with maybe, I don't know, 10 countries. And those were based on, like, where is their demand response market? Like, where does demand response exist? And, you know, that was a few countries in Europe, I think Mexico, Japan, and Australia. And then we narrowed it down to, I think, 3 or 4. And then we narrowed it from those 3 or 4. I think it was Japan, 1 or 2. I think the UK, maybe one other country, maybe Poland in Europe, and then Mexico and Australia. And then from there, we narrowed it down to Australia.
Okay, which is really interesting. So what were the factors that you looked at besides the demand?
Right. So other than the demand, the opportunity, so this, you know, the market that one existed and two was had opportunity and growth and policy that supported the future of demand response in those countries. We, you know, our leadership, our co-founders, CEO and president had previously been in Australia. And so they had connections, they knew people, they knew the market, they knew that there was more growth in the market. But also, where could we scale? So take the company we have right now, take the team that we're all about people. Like we love, like it's bright, gritty, good. These people are bright, gritty, good. We love them. How do we take them and make it scalable so that we can go into Australia without basically just having to build a whole new company? Mm-hmm. And one, obviously the depth of knowledge and the previous experience of our president and CEO, but two, they spoke English, right? So Australia speaks English. And that means Stephanie can still run operations with Australians in Australia. Yeah. But what my experience can translate, I don't have to learn a new language to be able to communicate with my growing team in Australia. My team in the US can, you know, they can scale and they can support the requirements in Australia as well. Obviously, you still hire locals and you still have a team and a local presence. But that doesn't mean you have to basically just mirror and build the exact same company with the exact same people, but in Australia. You can leverage your current team in a more optimized way.
Yes. So this is the part that I found was very interesting, because a lot of companies do this, is you'll go through the whole analysis. You start with 10, and then where you end up going is a country where your owner has experience and that they speak English. I mean, yeah. You had to, you know, and probably people want to go there from your bright, gritty, good team.
Right.
And it did have to have, you know, a business case there. So I find that fascinating, because sometimes companies will go to a place where the owner wants to go and they speak English, but they might miss bigger opportunities because of that fear of language and culture.
Yeah. And I think it's a really good point. And I think that if, you know, if it had been, I don't know, let's say Japan and Australia, and it was the exact same business case and it was the exact same ROI, I think 100% I would have voted for Australia also. But if there was, you know, significant difference in Japan, meaning like there was just so much more opportunity and it was just a much more favorable environment to grow and to nurture a company, I think it's a risk, but I do think that we would have done it.
Interesting.
I do think we would have done it. I think the English language would have definitely been a challenge, but if the opportunity was, like, our leadership, our founders are just, they don't shy away from a challenge. But they want to be thoughtful about the success and setting the company up for success, setting the, you know, the locals that we hire and that we expand and we create that business. We want to set them up for success. And so if there is a huge opportunity, language definitely plays a role in the evaluation. We 100% it came up when we talked about the different markets, but I do believe that we would have been up for the challenge. Now, I do not think I would have been able to learn Japanese.
No.
But
I mean, yes, you could. I'm not saying no, you couldn't. I'm saying yes, you could, but yeah. Is it worth your time to do?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it definitely would have been nerve-wracking for me. And I definitely think I would have had to hire someone more senior than in Japan than maybe I would have had to hire in Australia, because I would have needed someone more senior in Japan to help me with like strategy versus and executing it, versus in Australia, I could have someone who's more tactical because I could, and who could help me to provide data for the strategy, but because I could understand and like go talk back and forth through the details and the nitty gritty details of the like on the ground person providing me that data, it would inform my strategy. Whereas if I were in a country where I couldn't have those like back and forth and those dynamic working sessions where I could really hammer out the details so that I understood the tactics, that then I could raise myself up from understanding the tactics to help with the strategy. I don't think I could have done that in a country like Japan, where I wouldn't have been able to have those like iterations, those back and forth, unless I found someone who was Japanese, who spoke English, who knew the culture, who knew the economy, who knew the market and the opportunity, who then also spoke English to me. If I could find that person, then yeah, then I could still scale my skill set and leverage the local people. But
so as you're going into Australia, are you hiring a team on the ground?
Or
are
Yes.
So how many people do you have to hire? Because there's so many different ways to do this with companies going into other countries. Right. I mean, there's PEOs where you can hire one employee, you know, or a small team and run it through them. So you're not the employer of record, but you have this company. You can often work with partners or do a joint venture or, you know, some companies it's appropriate to have a distributor. So I'm curious as to what the launch looks like for you.
And that's actually, and that what you just described was a factor in our considerations. So do we, you know, are we the company of record? Do we hire or acquire a smaller demand response company that doesn't have as much experience with us, but is local and knows the local market? So that was those were factors in looking at the different markets. We went to Australia. Well, we didn't go to Australia yet, but we landed on Australia because we thought it was a blend. We thought we could find locals who knew the market, but they would work for Voltus. They would be part of Voltus, and it would be the Voltus name. And they would start small and then leverage the assets. So the assets being the team in the US, but they would have, there'd be a small group. Some of them may have been their current team who wanted to relocate. Some of them may, or some of them that we spoke with were locals, Australians, who are already in the market. And so we would have created a small team, maybe, you know, three people, four people, used the team, the US team, to help maximize the team on the ground.
So were those four people going to be mostly salespeople, business development?
Yeah, exactly. So they would have been go-to-market, right? And then once we got momentum, that's when we could grow the local team a little bit more, once we kind of saw where we needed to add different skill sets that couldn't be leveraged in the US or were maxed out in the US and needed to just focus on the Australian market. But yeah, start with a small team, and it was a go-to-market team. Correct.
Okay. Now, so your marketing for them or their sales material and your website, are you going to keep it in American English, or are you going to adapt it to Australian English?
Another great question that I don't have the answer for, but now that you've said it, I really do need to consider that. It's a really good point because we definitely do spell some of the words differently.
Different references and terminology and handle it different, whether they globalize or localize. So
And then also the .com versus I think like .au, right? Like, so so I think it was definitely part of our plan that we would need to have a alternative website, very similar structured with similar information. But again, you're right. We would need to adapt. These are the details where someone like you and your experience, I'd want to talk to you before we really like dove right in.
I know. And I love having these conversations to see how you're thinking about it, because you're a very strategic, intelligent woman. And so, you know, you have so many details to think through.
Well, the funniest thing was I do operations, and one of the functions that reports or falls under operations is field ops. And all I kept saying is, what about the outlets? I was like, I don't know about the outlets. I'm going to have to learn about their outlets because we have hardware and we build hardware.
And I was like, about the electrical wall outlets.
Like, oh my God, I have to learn about the outlets.
Yes. If you've done any international travel, you know your
phone. That's my hair dryer. That's all I think about. I'm like, oh my God, my hair dryer. It's never going to work. Yeah. It's going to be a mess. So that was what the thing that stood out. So go to market, we have an amazing depth of experience on our team on go to market. It was the hardware, the logistics. We build our own hardware and we ship from our warehouse. So our warehouse is in Texas. It's run by a veteran. Actually two veterans, one who like runs the warehouse and then my senior field ops, he's a veteran as well. So they're very on top of logistics. It's so nice having someone who I just don't have to think about it. They just get logistics. Yeah. But then you start adding in like shipping to Australia. And I'm like, I also have to find out how much it costs to ship to Australia and what their outlets are. And is our hardware going to have to other than the power source, do we have to start getting different pieces of equipment for Wi-Fi? Because our hardware plugs in and then it sends us a signal to our platform because it's sending us real-time data of the power usage. I'm like, okay, there's a lot I need to start looking into about things I never thought I would need to know, the Australian Wi-Fi situation. Or I guess maybe that's cellular. So cellular is what I needed to look into. So anyway.
So often that falls in a product manager's job or a marketing job is how do we adapt the product for international. So that's rolling all right up.
Is it? Okay, good. So I can go to Kelly, who runs our marketing, and ask her to help me with this. I'm going to let her know you told me that.
Adapting.
Okay.
Tell Kelly.
So Kelly, Wendy says you are going to be able to tell me about the cellular service in Australia.
See, marketing is magical. Marketing does everything.
Yes, they do. Yes. I agree. So when we were talking about Australia, I'm like, oh my God, the power outlets, how are we going to figure? I mean, obviously I'm exaggerating. Talking about this. We were very focused on, obviously go to market. And I was like, okay, but what about the logistics and our hardware? And so I'm the boring person. I always joke that I talk about the unsexy topics.
You know what? But this is so important because if somebody's thinking about going international and if they're a manufacturer, they do need to think these things through. So it's thinking about your end user and your customer, which is a part of marketing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, your product, your story, does it change? Yeah. And it does. I mean, maybe the fundamentals don't change, but the details and the execution, does it change because of culture? Does it change because of language? Does it change because of literally logistics and the tech like what you need to adapt in your technology, does it translate?
Right.
You know, how, like with companies like AWS, obviously they're international. So you have, when you talk, start talking about tech, you do have more options these days. You know, having servers and cloud, that's, there's this whole thing where, like, if you serve a European country, you need to have the servers in Europe. You can't be transferring data through the cloud in the, like, outside of Europe. So, like, but AWS has adapted to that. So they've given you that ability to say, like, listen, we need this data to be in, you know, AWS regions in Europe. So it is really interesting how the infrastructure, as it evolves, starts having more options for those international considerations.
Right, right. And we've seen tech companies that were built like just for one language.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they've decided to translate, it's so far down the line that the technology is not easy to adapt.
Yeah.
And that's really put a crink in how companies can expand or their users and the ability to use. And then we see other technology companies that build like a mirror site that plan out for the different languages. It takes the fonts. It's easy to go in and adapt it to a different language. So all these things are really important to think about at the beginning.
They are, right. Because a website, it's not like you can just do the Google Translator and say, translate this website into a different language. Because I've done that. I've accidentally landed on a non-English website. And then it's like, you know, in the upper right-hand corner of Chrome, it says like translate. And then I click it. I'm like, well, this doesn't make sense. I don't know what this website is saying.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so you mentioned Google Translate.
Yeah.
And you were laughing.
Well, yeah, I've been doing, you know, when I do research and I try and learn different things, I'll go down rabbit holes on Google and I'll find a website that maybe is in German, or a lot of websites have they're international, so they have different versions of their website. But if I find it in the German version and I can't figure out, because it's in German, where it says to change the website to English, I'll push the Chrome button in the upper right hand side that says translate this page.
Yeah.
And usually it translates it, but it's nonsensical, or it makes sense, but it's not. That's obviously not their English version. That will usually help me find where on the website I can go to their English version of their website. Usually it's a drop down that says different languages. But again, if it's in German or Dutch for some reason, because I'm always in the technical stuff, and so usually it's German or Dutch, I'll use the Google Translate to find where I can get to their English version of their website.
Okay, so what happens if they don't have translation? Like if you do that, find it, but there's no English part. Do you try to go through the bad translation?
To be honest,
yeah.
If Google Chrome's translate version does work and it makes sense, then great. I usually just close out and find a different website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what statistics show, that it's something like 96% of the people would rather read a website in their own language, and over 50% are willing to spend more money. But if it's not in their language, they leave.
Yeah.
You know, so just lost me. That business.
Right. But that's a really interesting statistic, and I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah. And so you're just saying it just from your experience. If you go there and it doesn't make sense, you leave, because you don't want to spend your time looking at it.
Right. Because I'm looking for information, and if I can't consume the information, then I you know, I need to go to the next, right? Go to the next one. So.
Right, right. So I'm kind of curious, because you've had this international work and, you know, your business is expanding, and I expect to go into countries that don't speak English. If you had to go about finding a translation expert, what would you do?
I am a
probably should be embarrassed by the following answer. So you please let me know if I should be embarrassed. I am emotionally prepared to be embarrassed. I would Google it.
You'd Google it. There you go. What would you Google? What would you put in?
Well, I guess it depends on the country, but I would enter, like, let's use Japan, Japanese business translator, or Japanese translator for business operations or something like that. I would definitely put like business in, because I think it's different, right? It's so conversational, and I bet if you put like translator, you'd probably get a lot of, if you put Japanese translator, and you'd probably just get a lot of technology that helps you like copy and paste or, you know, record something. When I'm looking for a human to work for the company, I would want to put in like business, partner, translator, linguist, maybe. So.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. I hadn't thought about that. We try to optimize for quality translation or maybe human translation, but I hadn't thought about business. So
that's, yeah, because it's different, right? I could have a conversation in Spanish with someone. Now, if you started speaking business to me in Spanish, I may agree to something that I did not mean to agree to.
So you're not going to do business in that language.
I'm not going to do business in Spanish, but I will have drinks and talk to someone or attempt to talk to someone in Spanish.
But not French.
Definitely not French.
You'd be flattered, but you won't speak it back.
I would be very flattered, but I would not. My aunt actually, and my cousins are French, so they will be horrified to hear this. My mother and aunt tried to get me to learn French growing up, and they spoke to me in French, and I would speak right back to them in English.
Well, that's very, very common.
Ruined opportunity by an immature child, so I regret it, but I do not.
Well, we lived in Mexico when I was in first and second grade, and my brothers were in preschool, and so they were perfectly fluent in English and Spanish, but couldn't separate out the languages.
Oh.
So my mom would use them as a very unofficial interpreter, because if somebody said something, she could say, "What did they say?" And they'd look at her weird and then repeat it in English, so they knew who to speak the language to. But when back to the United States, they pushed it down, because, you know, here were these little blonde haired kids running around speaking Spanish. People would laugh at them or say, "How cute." And they didn't want that attention.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. Oh, that is, I don't have very many regrets in life, but one of the regrets is that I do not speak another language. When someone tells me they speak fluently in two or more, three or four languages, and usually they're my European friends, the jealousy I have for them is epic. I just am like, my response is, I'm still working on English. So,
yeah. Well, see, and I'll start a lot of speaking engagements, although I haven't done it recently, but I used to. I'd say, how many languages do you need to speak to do international business?
Oh, that's, and what's the answer?
Well, what would you think?
I would think, international, I would say probably one has to be English. I would say minimum two. But if you speak English, you can get away with it probably a little more. But if you don't speak English, you probably should learn the second language, which would be English, which, oh my God, oh, everyone international now hates me. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, but see, my answer, here's the punchline, is you just need to know one language, because with a good translation interpretation agency, you can speak any language you want to.
There you go. There. All right. I stepped right into it. Okay, good. I'm glad. I fell for it. So yes. Okay. I rescind my answer of two. It is one. You need one.
a great team
to help with the translation.
Yes, and a lot of manufacturers are finding that, you know, when it was a struggle to hire people, if they tapped into the communities that didn't speak English, mm-hmm. smart ones weren't trying to teach the employees English. What they did was make it a very inclusive and equitable workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And people could get really good jobs with benefits and have promotion abilities and bring their friends and family into work. And the manufacturers that would have these excellent workers that were really dedicated and loyal because they could have a job where they didn't have to speak English as long as the company was doing it. So
I love that. Yeah. I love that. That is, I love that. That's the kind of thing I want to hear is we're very big on like team and being part of a team and feeling like you have a career path, no matter what entry, no matter how you enter the company, you should feel like you're contributing and you have value because you do, and that you also have a career. It's not just a job. It's a culture. It's part of, you spend so much time doing it, you want to show up and feel like you're part of something.
And that's as long as you're not requiring that somebody in the U.S. has to speak English. You can still do all the training. You can put in bilingual supervisors and managers, right, and get really good quality people, because they're very educated in their home country.
Right. Exactly. And you don't eliminate great talent because of the language. You are able to do that. That's actually really interesting, because our founders, we're a virtual company. This was before COVID-19. We were a virtual company. And the whole reason we are a virtual company is because of talent. They never wanted location to be a factor into being able to find the best talent available.
Right.
So that aligns exactly with what you're saying. It's the same exact theory is don't let this one factor eliminate. So ours was location, and yours, what you're speaking of, is language. Don't let language or don't let location be the detriment to being able to find the best available talent to build the best team available.
Right. And I think that's with creative problem solving, is looking at things that weren't previously considered to really make the company work.
Right. I love that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So what mistakes would you anticipate or have you seen with people trying to do business internationally?
So one is, even if you think your countries are very aligned with where you've had previous experience, like for example, the US and Canada, the regulations, the policy are very different. And so I think if you go in and say, this is the frame, this is the structure that worked here, wherever it is, but in our case, it's the US, and now we're going to just replicate that structure in the next country, and you don't take into consideration the culture, the environment in which you are going, and the environment can be government, regulation, policy, language, a culture, like how do people work? Are they a culture where, you know, it's a typical 9-to-5, or what are the expectations? What is a good quality of life for the team that you would then bring on in that next country? I think some of the challenges we've faced is that it's not the same, right? In even Canada and the US, it's very different. In Canada, this is like a little example of structure and how it can be very, like, it can impact the structure that you think is scalable. You cannot you can't cold call in Canada. So unless, really? I don't have that much background in it. I just know that I have to be very careful. I work with customers, right? So I'm on ops and customer success. And so for me, I can talk to anyone in Canada because they're our customer. So they have an agreement with us. So they know who we are. But when we're marketing and we're trying to develop leads and we're trying to do campaigns and we're trying to invite people to webinars, there are limitations. And you have to be very careful about your outreach in Canada. And so we have a communications platform. We use HubSpot. And so HubSpot takes that into consideration, but we can't accidentally put a Canadian email in the same campaign as a bunch of US prospects, because it's much stricter And so we have to segment, and then we have to make sure that we're following the rules. And when we prospect in Canada, we have to be very careful to follow the rules in Canada.
Okay, so that's much more similar to Europe, where they have GDPR regulations where you can't just cold email people.
Okay, yeah.
But I think you could call them on the telephone. Are you still finding limitations?
So maybe I am. So I know there's one thing that has to happen. So I think you can call them, but uh-huh. if they agree, you can put them on the mailing list.
Yes. So it's the whole opt in.
They have to opt in, but I don't know if we're allowed to pick up the phone and conflating the two. So maybe you can get a phone call in, cold call, and then if they are okay with it, then you can follow up with an email. I think that might be
okay. Helpful. So it's more of the opt-in, where right? You're going to send them emails or invite them to things. They have to opt into right. it. Whereas here in the US, like, they marketers will talk about it being best practice to opt in, but I still think there's people who do cold email, because I get them all the time.
I get them all the time too. Right.
Yeah.
And we do them because I would prefer to get an email, to be perfectly honest, because it allows me to read and research and like consume information before I'm put on the spot to call. That's just my opinion. But I also know there's so many of them that they can get lost. So I do understand the cold calling. So I was surprised. This is, I think, why I have so much trouble understanding the rules. And so, to be clear, I don't do.
Yeah, that's out of your realm. Discussion with operations and thinking through and everything
right.
that can happen.
And so because I have to make sure, I communicate very closely with our head of marketing. And so I do know they're like, okay, in my communication, this is, to be clear, this is customers only. So, okay, Canada's okay. So there are things like that, like you would never like, okay, this is our campaign for whatever product. Let's send it to all of our prospects. Well, are your prospects in countries where that is not allowed? So clean things, things, straightforward things like that, that you would never think about. You have to think about like how has your company been lead generation and been successful? Does that translate in the next country that you're going to? If not, like that go-to-market strategy is going to be turned upside down, potentially.
Right, right. Because then you run into the regulations and you get shut down and then you can't do outreach. So it would be worthwhile speaking to marketers or salespeople or go-to-market people in the other countries.
Right. So how is your go-to-market engine been successful to the point where you now want to grow? Okay. Yeah. Does that engine translate to go-to-market in this new market or this new country that you're going into, regardless of the language? Does that work? Because if not, your system, your structure, your team might be thrown for a loop there.
Which I think would be really interesting, that if you put together a process or a template for going into Australia, because you're confronting all that stuff now,
right.
Build that template out. Then when you go into Japan, you could use an interpreter to get the information to fill that in.
Right, right.
And then you wouldn't have to worry about hiring a bilingual person. You could hire a Japanese speaking person.
Right. And or you'd want a bilingual person or a translator who's looking at your model mm-hmm. and has the business background to understand what that model is actually saying. So like the words are one thing, but what does it mean?
Yes.
And then does that translate to Japan, and or are there challenges? Like, okay, this is your objective or this is your goal and this is how you achieve that typically. Okay, mm-hmm. Those steps that you take to achieve that, two of those things you're not allowed to do, or two of those things are very challenging because of X, Y, and Z. For example, you cannot send a cold email. I won't say cold call, but a cold email.
Yeah.
So if that's how you're going to generate a lot of your lead and your momentum, I want to let you know that that doesn't quote unquote translate.
to culturally translate. Yeah, but this is how we can adapt it for the culture and move it forward. Exactly.
Because they have that, they understand what you're saying, like explicitly in the words, but they also understand what it means in business. Like a translator who has that, that depth of knowledge would be so invaluable, in my opinion.
Well, that's an interpreter, and a well-trained interpreter who has subject matter expertise can help facilitate that conversation. So you have the knowledge in the Japanese person, and then you've got interpreters are trained to be a conduit of information.
Got it. Okay. So
I think you going in cold to a new market that doesn't speak English with what you've talked about and where you are specifically for your country doesn't make sense. You've already picked Australia. Mm-hmm. Now build that template, find somebody that can talk about that and facilitate the conversation with a Zoom interpreter or a telephone interpreter or a live in-person event whenever we can.
Right, right. Yeah, no, you're right. That is the right term. I was using the wrong, like that is exactly what it is. It is an interpreter. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, people outside the industry don't use them.
I'm learning because I think this company is going to grow and beyond English speaking countries. So I'm going to put that in my noggin. Yeah.
All right. So now let's go to some quick fire personal questions.
Okay.
Okay. What's been your favorite vacation?
Any vacation, I guess.
Love that answer. That's a first.
Oh, good. Okay. No, but really.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
A favorite memory or most rewarding cross-cultural experience?
Oh, gosh. Bahrain. Living in Bahrain.
Okay.
So it's the Middle East. I mean, it's not Iraq, it's not Afghanistan, but it is the Middle East, and it's important. It's because the Middle East is always in conversation, so it's important to understand the culture, to be informed, and then to have much better conversations and dialogue.
Okay. Favorite place to do business?
Do you mean where I am located to do it, or where the business is happening?
Maybe country or culture.
Yeah.
Culture to do business with.
I'm going to say the U.S. Right now, at least the U.S. Innovative. And I love it. I love the U.S. Again, not internationally popular statement, but I'm just speaking the truth. I love the U.S. and I love our water pressure.
And most of the time, no rolling blackouts.
Most of the time, no rolling blackouts. Gosh.
And then your favorite foreign word?
Oh, let's see. Touché. It's probably tied with hors d'oeuvre. So I love hors d'oeuvres. I love them. And touché is one of my favorite words just in all languages. It says so much with one word, and the delivery, and it can be humorous. It can be like, okay, I stand corrected. Like it can be the end. It can end a fight.
You're so gracious. Most people think of touché and they go, aha, I got you. Do touché, you got me. No wonder you're so well loved and successful.
Yeah, that's like, all right, I stand corrected. So that's my, oh gosh, am I not interpreting that word properly? Have I been using it improperly?
No, you're using it in a very kind way.
Okay, good. Yeah, and it's a word I use a lot. So I don't know if that's reflective of me losing a lot of battles or not, but that is a word I either fortunately or unfortunately use a lot. So, and hors d'oeuvres are something I just consume a lot of. So those are my two probably favorite words English or other language.
And well, of course, they're French. Interesting that they're French, not so Spanish.
I do speak French. I lied.
All right. And any final recommendations for our listeners who want to do global marketing or expand internationally?
I think it's exciting. And so I think definitely evaluate it. I won't say definitely do it, but it definitely consider it, because not only is it exciting, it also can be when you have to reflect on your current model, and it can be really valuable and powerful evaluation of your current model, and can open up opportunities in your current country or countries to do things better, to build structure in a better way that makes it scalable, so that when you are, when you have that foundation, you can continue to grow. So just by doing the exercise, I think is really valuable and can uncover some gaps, and can uncover some areas of improvement, or can uncover some really powerful strength that you should leverage more. And so I think the exercise in itself is really powerful and valuable.
Excellent. All right. So where can people find you if they want to learn more about you?
Oh, gosh, I'm on LinkedIn. I think, is that how people find people now? I don't know. Yeah. So LinkedIn, my name is Stephanie Hendricks, and I'm pretty sure it's straight to the point on LinkedIn, but let me just triple check. Yep, Stephanie Hendricks. And
H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S.
Yes.
And your company name, Voltus, V-O-L-T-U-S, and they should be able to find you and connect.
Right. And if they want to email me, I'm pretty good at email. It's S, as in Stephanie. So it's S Hendricks, H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S, at Voltus, V-O-L-T-U-S.co, not .com. I always,
oh, okay.
Yes, it's .co. So. Good. I love emails. So if anyone wants to,
I think that's a first too.
Really?
Oh. I love email.
I'm pretty good at email. I always read my emails. Sometimes I delay on getting back to people, but I always read them. I like to see who's reaching out, but,
yes, that's true.
Yeah. I have a feeling I'm going to have some people horrified by my okay, I take criticism. I take constructive feedback. I don't take criticism. I take constructive feedback.
Well, I think the conversation has been absolutely delightful, and you gave me some very good insights, even though I do this all day. So,
and you too. I've learned. So I've learned a lot. I'm excited to keep our conversations going, because I think you have a lot of experience and intelligence that's really valuable, especially where we are when we're thinking about going to Australia.
Happy to help in any way I can. Sure. Well, thank you, listeners, for listening in. I hope you learned something today, or at least had a chuckle. If you can, tell anybody who's in global marketing or is interested in global marketing to listen. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time. And remember, you can find the Global Marketing Podcast on all your favorite places to listen to podcasts.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.